And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Welcome back to part two.
It's been 3 seconds for us and a week for you.
Right. So we're recording this all as a batch just because we have just so many thoughts. It's just easier to get it out all at once. Puts us ahead of schedule, which is nice too. We just left off. We have revealed that Scabbers is really Peter Pettigrew, that Sirius is a blameless man, and Peter has really been the one to blame for Harry's parents dying. We are exiting the tunnels, leaving the Shrieking Shack.
Yes.
As we're in the tunnels, this moment, so pure.
Before this, there's a really funny part where, so here's the lowdown on how they're leaving the shack. They've bound up Peter. They've shackled him on one side to Ron, whose leg is now splinted, and on the other side to Remus. Snape has already said, I don't think we mentioned this last episode, Snape, when he came into the shack, has already mentioned that he was able to come because he went to Remus's office to give him his potion, which he forgot about. Spoiler alert. Remus freaking forgets about his monthly potion. Snape sees the map open and goes to find them. But keep in mind, Remus has forgotten about his potion. So they're all walking out. And then Sirius has Snape's wand in hand, and he's dragging Snape, who has been set up with a mobile corpus spell, and he's floating along down the tunnel. Then Harry and Hermione are walking together. There's a part where Harry noticed Snape's head like scraping the top of the tunnel and said that Sirius was making no effort to prevent it, which is bad, but also a funny visual.
It's also impressive the level of magic that Sirius has after not being able to use magic for 12 years.
That's true. And also using a different wand.
Right. It's pretty impressive. I think that just shows his skill. So Sirius says to Harry, basically, that like he wants to get his life on track and have Harry come and live with him because he's Harry's godfather.
And he loves that boy.
Yes, and he loves that boy. And Harry is like, yeah, sure, sounds great. I just thought you killed my parents an hour ago, but now we're cool. It sounds awesome.
But think about comparatively, his thinking is, this was my parents' absolute best friend. And that is a huge step up from living with the Dursleys. So even without a lot of trust established, Harry's like, yes, absolutely.
I think Dumbledore probably would have never gone for this idea.
No.
It's a full moon. Because, of course.
I want to talk about how this makes no sense. It says, okay, they're walking out across the grounds. It's nighttime. The moon has been out. And then it's like, oh, and then a cloud shifted and suddenly Remus transformed.
Yeah.
What? That is not, that is the werewolf being able to see the moon, according to the rest of the lore from the series, has nothing to do with their transformation. Like, thinking about it, Remus, during his transformations while he was at school, would have been in the shack with all the windows boarded up, unable to see the moon anyway, and he would still transform. So it should have nothing to do with the moon being visible, and this helps the plot that it was already nighttime, but Remus had to tell them this whole story and had to be around for it. So I guess him now seeing the moon makes him transform, but I just want to say it makes no sense.
Peter stuns Ron.
Yeah, he gets hold of Remus's wand.
First time we've been introduced to the stunning spell. And makes a mad dash for it.
And Sirius, you know, would go for Peter, but his priority is to protect Harry and the kids. So he transforms into Padfoot and is fighting with Remus. They bloody each other up. Actually, it doesn't say that Remus gets bloodied at all. So Sirius at least gets bloodied. Remus runs off into the forest as a werewolf. Harry says, Sirius, Peter got away. So Sirius goes off after Peter down to the lake. And that ends up presenting a problem because there are hundreds of Dementors down there.
God, the movie does a really great job with this visual. Well, they're there.
Could they sense him?
Yeah, they could. They can't sense him when he's in his dog form, but when he's in his people form, they can sense him.
That's right. Harry runs down after Sirius. And so does Hermione, for that matter. We don't see that in the film. But Ron's stunned and on the ground, and he's not in any immediate danger anymore, so they leave him. And then they leave Snape as well, who eventually snaps out of it pretty quick, actually. And they go down to the lake, and Sirius is down on his knees in front of these Dementors. There's this very sweet line. Harry's like, he didn't think, he thought only of Sirius. And he like suddenly is very loyal to this man. Now, having heard the story, he understands what's happening. I wrote literally about four notes for this whole chapter because my face was just glued to the book the whole time.
I didn't write a lot of notes either. For the end of the book, I didn't write a lot of notes.
To be fair, there's a lot of action and there's not a ton to analyze really, but the whole imagery of the Dementors in this section is absolutely horrifying. It's just horrifying. And then Hermione faints and they're about to go down and perform the kiss on Sirius, and they're about to perform the kiss on Harry. And then across the lake, Harry sees this big silver thing and it's running around and it's chasing all the Dementors away. And he's about to pass out. As he's looking up, the last thing he sees, he thinks, is his father across on the other bank of the lake. This poor kid has gone through so much tonight.
Literally kills me.
Harry, I always think about how at the end of the series, Harry needs extensive therapy after all of this, because he just goes through so much for being such a young person. He's had to deal with discovering that the man he thought killed his parents is not actually the man he thinks killed his parents. Then he finds out this other man tried to kill his parents. He gets to see him, and then Lupin's this werewolf, and then he hears about their whole relationship to his father, and he didn't know how deep it was, and he thinks he sees his dad. And that's the end of chapter 20. It's brief. In fact, it's very brief.
I think it's worth noting, the first two books have sort of given us this formula for
how Harry's year is going to go.
Harry's happy at Hogwarts, bad guy comes, the trio forms a plot to defeat bad guy defeated, Harry happy. This is the first one that's going to jolt that natural order.
I think that's one of the things that makes this book so interesting. It is divergent from, how the other two have gone. And also the film is very different than how the other two were, because there was a different director. But a lot of things are different in the film. Yes.
Yeah, if we were following that, prior formula, we would think that Harry would be able to leave the Dursleys, Sirius would have his name cleared, all would be well, but that's
not what happens. Oh my God.
So going into chapter 21, Hermione's secret.
This is so good. The whole plot with the time turner, I think, is so cool. It's one of the things about this book is there's so many like new introductions to magical things we didn't get to hear about before. We open the chapter with Harry waking up in the hospital wing and hearing this conversation between Snape and Fudge. And Snape is talking to Fudge about what's happened, and Fudge is thanking him for his service, saying he's going to get Order of Merlin. And Snape mentions, of course, Potter has always been allowed an extraordinary amount of license by the headmaster. And Fudge goes, "Ah, well, Snape, Harry Potter, we've all got a bit of a blind spot where he's concerned." And Snape goes, "And yet, is it good for him to be given so much special treatment?"
Yeah, he is pretty right.
Then again, he keeps going on. He's like, "I treat him like every other student," which I'm like, "No, you don't. You abuse him a little bit.
I love that Poppy tells the Minister of Magic that he needs to leave.
She's awesome. He outs Remus to Fudge.
Yep. Rude.
So rude! So uncalled for! And I get it. Remus's condition did not go very well tonight. Pretty irresponsible of him to forget his potion. Things aren't looking good for him. But that is not Snape's information to tell the Minister of Magic. That is Dumbledore's information to tell.
Precisely.
He's just out to get Lupin. It's just awful. And then they wake up and Madame Pomfrey's, you're right, she's trying to get the Minister and Snape out of there, but Harry and Hermione are trying to tell them that they've got the wrong guy, and Snape is like, "No, don't listen to them. They've been confunded. Sirius Black used a confundus charm." I don't think he really believes Sirius used a confundus charm. I think he doesn't want his triumph to be spoiled.
I have a different opinion on that, but...
Please share it. It's okay.
No, I don't know that he cares about the Order of Merlin. I don't know that he does. I really believe that by Sirius being guilty, it absolves Snape of something. I think that because of that, he like truly believes that Sirius is guilty.
Okay.
I don't think Snape is chasing a particular sort of glory here.
I think it's a little bit of his Slytherin ambition coming out. The reason Snape joined the Death Eaters in the first place is he was attracted to a certain sort of power that he didn't have before, and he gained a lot of status in that organization. I think he's a little bit attracted to power.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that. No, I agree that is why he became a Death Eater. I think his motives have drastically changed since then. This probably is 15 years later. I think he's a really a different person, in some ways for the better, in some ways not for the better. We don't really know by canon, but my gut says that Snape is not so concerned with the Order of Merlin so much as he's concerned with Sirius.
Sticking it to Sirius.
Yeah. And I don't even know that sticking it makes it seem like he's doing it in a smug way. I just really believe in his gut, he has told himself so many times that Sirius is to blame for Lily's death. That is just like how he views it, and you can't change his mind.
I agree. I think there is smugness. He's acting like a jerk. Snape yells at Hermione again, and even Fudge is like, okay, don't yell at the little girl. Dumbledore shows up and he's like, everybody leave, I need to talk to Harry. And Snape is pissed. Snape is like, surely you don't believe what they're saying about Sirius. Not only is he thinking about what the kids have said, Dumbledore has just gotten back from talking to Sirius.
Right.
He got to talk to Sirius, which is really good. So Snape's like, you don't believe this story. And Dumbledore's like, Dumbledore dismisses him. He's like, I just want to talk to Harry and Hermione alone. Snape took a step towards Dumbledore. Sirius Black showed he was capable of murder at the age of 16, he breathed. You haven't forgotten that, headmaster. You haven't forgotten that he once tried to kill me. My memory is good as it ever was, Severus, said Dumbledore quietly. Just totally dismisses him. Snape storms out. Hermione and Harry try and tell Dumbledore what's going on, and he's like, I believe you, but nobody else is going to. And then he turns to Hermione, he's like, three turns should do it, and leaves.
Obviously, we learn that Hermione has been given a time turner.
With special permission from the ministry, which is that they'd let a 13-year-old have a contraption like this.
That's how she's been able to take all these classes. Ron has been on to this for a while. Hermione tells Harry, this is how I've been getting back and forth to all my classes. That's the plan. They're going to do three turns and go change the entire events of the book.
Harry even goes, this is the weirdest thing we've ever done. I'm like, yeah, it's kind of weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Pretty weird. They can see themselves going down to Hagrid's under the cloak. These are some smart 13-year-olds is something I wrote down. To figure this out in their brain, they're like, oh, I guess we need to free Buckbeak too so that Sirius has a way to escape. Dumbledore told them nothing. They just have to work it out.
Question.
I would not have been able to work this out as a
13-year-old. If Lupin was watching the Marauders map all night, wouldn't he have noticed that there were two Harrys and two Hermiones walking around?
That is such a good question. Do you show up twice if you're time traveling? I guess the Marauders didn't make a provision for that. They free Buckbeak.
They free Buckbeak, yep.
They're keeping him in the forest. Fudge is like, oh no, this is going to look really bad for me.
Yeah, this is Fudge.
He doesn't care. He's just like, this is going to look bad for me. And then Dumbledore is like, oh, Hagrid, can I come in? I want some tea or a large brandy. They're hiding in the forest waiting for the time when they can go get Sirius out of the tower, but Harry's also thinking about how he thought he saw his dad, and he wants to go see if that theory was correct. Mm-hmm. So this does not happen like it does in the book at all. Lupin transforms. They end up hiding in Hagrid's hut for a little bit because they saw Hagrid walking around. He's just super happy about Buckbeak and like having a drink out on the grounds, which is dangerous for Hagrid because there's a werewolf running around now. So they go hide in his hut, and then Harry is like, oh, I need to leave to go see if it's time to go get Sirius out of the tower yet. Really, he's not going to do that. He wants to go down to the lake and see who he saw conjure whatever they conjured to get the Dementors away. So you got this moment. I cried three times while rereading this, and this was number three. Goes down to the lake, sees all the Dementors across the other bank, and then he has this epiphany that it wasn't his dad who he saw conjure the Patronus, it was himself. So he conjures the Patronus. This is the first time, actually, I think Dumbledore mentions he saw the Patronus as a corporeal Patronus at the Quidditch match. But this is the first time that Harry's seen his corporeal Patronus, and this beautiful giant stag rides across the lake and chases away the Dementors and comes back. And Harry looks at him and he realizes, because they didn't tell Harry what sort of animal his father transformed into his animagus form in the shack. They just said he was a big animal who could control a werewolf. And he looks at the stag and he says, prongs. And he realizes that's his dad's animagus form, was a stag.
So cute.
And he tries to pet it, and then it disappears. So cute. So they get on Buckbeak. They go save Sirius.
Why do they put Sirius in a place that has a window? This man just escaped Azkaban. You're not thinking he could get out of a window?
Yeah. And they're like, oh.
Convenient plot.
He doesn't have a wand and he can't operate in Hogwarts. Convenient for Hermione, I guess.
Really Sirius asks how Ron is doing.
I wrote that down too. He's very sweet. He cares about
very compassionate.
Their well-being. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess the way Sirius is perceiving it, other than just like being afraid for the safety of a child, because he's the one who hurt Ron and he probably feels bad. But also it's, he even mentioned it in the shack. He's like, your dad would have done the same thing for me. I think he views Harry and Ron's bond and Harry and Ron and Hermione's bond as like the bond he had with James and Remus. We are now into chapter 22.
Owl post again.
Yes. So they get back to the hospital wing in time. They dodge Peeves. They dodge Snape and Fudge. Fudge is talking to Snape about how he's going to get an Order of Merlin and a first class if he can help it for all he's done to catch Sirius Black. They then go realize that Sirius is not there and Harry and Hermione are like waiting and they hear them start yelling. Snape bursts in the room and he's like, Harry, how did Harry, he did this. I know he did this. And he reminds me of Mr. Crocker from Fairly Oddparents where he's like, I know that. I just can't prove it.
And Fudge is like way more preoccupied with the Daily Prophet finding out about what has happened with Sirius than Sirius actually escaping.
Yes, absolutely. And even Dumbledore says, going back to Snape actually being disappointed about the Order of Merlin and just, you know, him not being the one to catch Sirius, or not, he's not going to be seen as the one who caught Sirius Black. Dumbledore is even like, you know, he's fine. He's just suffered a severe disappointment. And it's, again, it's like that ambitious side of him, that like Slytherin ambition gone wrong, because ambition's not a bad trait in itself, but this is the dark side of that trait.
Right. I thought it was funny when, you know, Snape's freaking out, like, how did Harry do it? How did he do it? And Dumbledore says, it's impossible that Harry could be in two places at once, especially because I would think Snape knows about the time turner, because he's a head of house. He's one of the professors and he's one of Dumbledore's most trusted advisors. And we know that Fudge is aware of the time turner, but he's basically like, he's too blind to see that that could have been an option.
That Fudge is necessarily aware from the time turner, but McGonagall had to write to the ministry to get permission for Hermione to use it, but we don't know if Fudge was the one who handled that. There's no reason why he shouldn't have that information, but maybe that's just not something they informed him of.
Yeah, I guess I thought that he does know, but is just too unobservant because he's so concerned with just how this is going to look in the morning's paper.
That could very well be the case.
But I feel like Dumbledore says to Snape, it's impossible that Harry could be in two places at once. And I mean, we don't have canon to support this, but I feel that Snape definitely knows. And Dumbledore is basically just going over Fudge's head and telling Snape, you know, shut your mouth.
Probably.
And Snape does shut up right after this interaction.
And then he gets them back.
Dumbledore mentions in this chapter that Professor Trelawney has now made two actual predictions.
Wait, we can't get there yet.
Oh.
They leave the hospital wing at noon the next day, and everyone's in Hogsmeade, but it's so nice outside that they go to the lake to sort of debrief what happened, the trio, and they find Hagrid, and he's like, you'll never guess what happened. Buckbeak escaped. They're like, wow, no way. And then he's like, you know, because Lupin's leaving, you know, he says he never ate anything last night, but I was worried that Buckbeak was going to, you know, meet Lupin in the forest. And they kind of perk up and they're like, what? And then Hagrid's like, oh, you didn't hear? Professor Snape told all the Slytherins this morning that Lupin is a werewolf. I will never forgive him for this. Because Lupin already did not live a great life before, like between Lily and James dying and him coming to Hogwarts, like those 12 years were already not awesome for him. Now his life is going to be extra not awesome because now he's known to be a werewolf by the ministry and it's like common knowledge now because Snape has leaked it to students. And werewolves in the wizarding world are completely ostracized. He won't be able to get a job. He won't have financial stability. And we don't really know what happens to him in Goblet of Fire. The author forgot about him and doesn't write about him.
No, we don't get anything. It's so stupid.
It's so stupid. What happens to him?
One of the best characters. She spent so much time building up his like arc and then just drops him off the face of the earth for a whole book. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, there's no defense. That sucks. Snape did not do the right thing. I mean, Lupin was not long out for the position anyway, because as we know,
the position is cursed. But what a way to go.
Yeah, it's definitely a shame.
So Harry obviously runs to Lupin's office and he's like, don't go. You're the best teacher we've ever had. And obviously Harry is now sort of now knowing what he knows about Lupin and his relationship to his father. Harry's got this attachment to Lupin. Like, again, he's sort of his most trusted adult in his life right now. And it's just so sad. And Lupin's, you know, he seems to be in good spirits, and he's putting on a good face for Harry, but I think he's just devastated because I think he really loved teaching. I headcanon that at some point during this day after coming back, first of all, I don't know why he's not bedridden after this transformation, because it was a rough one. It had to have been bad. And you know, he got a little bit beat up by Sirius, but he's up and about. And this is just another way that the author does not write about his condition very well, as like a sort of like a chronic illness, and what the effects really would be of that. But anyway, I headcanon that he probably stormed up to Dumbledore's office at some point, maybe when he was resigning, and just like started screaming at him because Dumbledore didn't realize that Sirius was innocent. Or if he did, he never said anything and he just like let him rot in a cell in Azkaban. I think Lupin's was probably pissed at Dumbledore.
Yeah, I can see that. He's just such a level-headed guy though.
Yeah. Yeah, but when it comes to everything that went down with that, you know, you're right, he was pretty level-headed. That's anyway, but the fact of the matter is Dumbledore sort of used him as a chess piece on his little board this year.
Again, every chess piece.
And Dumbledore's in it for the long haul. He just wants to see Voldemort defeated, and that requires some like pretty bad sacrifices along the way. But like Lupin ended up being a great teacher, but I don't think he was just hired because Dumbledore knew he was going to be a good teacher, because then he would have been brought on earlier as a professor. He was hired because of his relation to Sirius Black. Dumbledore totally used him. Mm-hmm. So sad. And then Harry's talking to Dumbledore about Trelawney's prediction.
Right. And we get, this is just our standard end of book debrief with Dumbledore.
It's funny that, because a lot of the conversation that happens in this, in the film, is given to Sirius, which I think is sweet. But yeah, so Dumbledore gets a lot of these lines.
So.
You want to talk about Trelawney?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Harry tells Dumbledore about the prophecy, right? So, and Dumbledore doesn't really seem so shocked by the prophecy. I guess it's nothing super like big news, but he doesn't seem really surprised. But he does tell Harry that Professor Trelawney has now made two actual predictions, but he doesn't tell Harry what the other prediction is. And we're going to learn more about that. Like, we're basically going to go through all of Goblet of Fire, not really learn about that, but that's a good thing to keep in the back of our mind when we get to Order of the Phoenix. And that's sort of like, this book is very connected to Order of the Phoenix.
Yes.
And 2 and 6 are very connected together. Yes. And 4 kind of like breaks everything up in a really sort of like different way. So anyway, just something to keep in the back of your head. I feel like Dumbledore does a lot of like wink at the camera moments, you know, in this.
Yeah, like hinting at something that Harry like ends up finding out in a horrible way later that Dumbledore doesn't tell him for good reason, but like.
Exactly. So we get a little bit of a clue that Dumbledore knew James very well, that James spent a lot of time in Dumbledore's office. And we have kind of been hinted at that before, because when Harry gets the invisibility cloak, right, Dumbledore says that James had given it to Dumbledore to study.
Yeah.
And now he's basically just giving it back to its rightful owner. Yeah, that's kind of that's it. He goes into a little bit more about how, you know, how Peter's shame and regret for what he has done and Harry's mercy will eventually pay dividends later, and how
it does.
How Peter owes Harry, you know, a life debt for what totally. Has happened.
And then Dumbledore goes into how he talked to Sirius when Sirius was up in Flitwick's office and got a little bit more of an explanation, which is something he couldn't bother to do before Sirius went to Azkaban, but whatever. He goes and talks to Sirius, and Sirius is the one who's like, we became Animagus, and that's how I've been getting around. I've been a dog. And then he told him about James, because Dumbledore says this line to Harry when Harry tells him about the Patronus. He says, Prongs rode again last night.
It's too much, honestly.
It's too much. Do you have anything more about his conversation with Dumbledore?
Not really. We sort of get, then we go into our classic, you know, conclusion of book.
And Harry's not as like happy at the end of this book as he has been at the other two.
Happy ending, you know?
And he's especially unhappy that he has missed the opportunity to leave the Dursleys and go live with Sirius. Can you imagine if he had gone to live with Sirius? Harry suddenly would have become the coolest person ever, would have been very good with women.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that Dumbledore like purposely saw Sirius to Azkaban, you know, and like didn't stick up for him more, but Harry's life would have been so different if he was with Sirius. And like you said, I don't think Sirius would have allowed Dumbledore to sort of like, Snape says it really well in Deathly Hallows, where he says you were raising him like a pig for slaughter. And Sirius would have never let that happen to Harry. And he would have been much more like, no, there's another way we can fight this. Like, we can be more brave. We can be more forceful. Like, we can fight a war and win. We don't have to send Harry like into the trenches.
You're right.
We see that a lot in Order of the Phoenix, where Harry's like, no, he deserves to know. He deserves to be part of this. Like, and so I don't know that Dumbledore was super motivated in like getting Sirius out of Azkaban and placing Harry with him. Like, Sirius was kind of like where he was and wasn't causing trouble to Dumbledore's master plan.
Absolutely. And that's a really dark thought. But again, that goes back to, you know, it's a means to an end for Dumbledore. And then like, Dumbledore's right. He like Dumbledore or Voldemort gets defeated by the end of the series, but at what cost?
Right.
You know, like every one of the Marauders ended up dying a horrible death to protect Harry. And then Harry, you know, we find out that Dumbledore has been intending for Harry to die.
I just think Dumbledore saw things.
He saw the end game. He saw things from like an aerial point of view.
Right. And I think he did love Harry in his own way. I think he cared for a lot of people. I think he cared for Lupin. I think he cared for James and Lily, you know. But I think he has this boundary where it's kind of like, yes, I love you, but I don't love you enough to like protect you from what needs to be done. You know, like, this is how it has to play out.
Yeah.
Even though it's ugly. And he was very much that way. He was very utilitarian about his own death. He was like, I have to die. Like, I have been kept alive enough. Like, Severus, you've kept me alive enough. You have helped me with my gross hand disease. But
you're right. It is utilitarian.
I have to die. Like, I have to die. And then Harry has to go it alone. And you have to see to it that all the other steps that I have aligned to happen, I've set the dominoes up, and you just need to keep making sure that they move. And if Malfoy can't kill me, Severus, it has to be you. Like, he is just so utilitarian about it.
About people's lives. It's a little bit disturbing, but I mean,
but I think everything
his plan ends up working.
He went through not the same thing, but a very similar thing with Grindelwald. And I think he had a drastically different approach. And it didn't really work out. And I think he sees Voldemort as like a greater evil, a worse evil. And he's like, you know what? We're going to make sacrifices, and I'm going to sacrifice, and you have to sacrifice. And he's wise enough to see the end game.
That, and I think, you know, because of, And again, this is another thing that the author was like, until Fantastic Beasts, she was like, hey, guess what? Dumbledore's gay. Like one of those post-series things that she came out with, but couldn't bother to write into the series originally because she's awful. But I think now knowing what we know about what is happening in the Fantastic Beasts series, it's like Dumbledore, like his fight with Grindelwald is emotional for him because of his attachment to Grindelwald romantically. And the way he deals with Voldemort is very like anti-emotional and you're right, utilitarian. And I think he probably learned from his mistake with Grindelwald in his approach to how he deals with Voldemort and like the people who have to die in order for Voldemort to be vanquished. And this begs a darker question. After the first prophecy that said, you know, the one who's going to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches, born in the seventh month to parents who have thrice defied him, blah blah blah, did Dumbledore know that James and Lily had to die?
This is the greatest question of the series, is how much did Dumbledore know and how much was he controlling? And there's been a lot of hints that this series is designed sort of like biblically a little bit, you know, it has a lot of the same elements or themes as like Christianity, and that Dumbledore is sort of this like Aslan or like God character who kind of is just like shifting the pieces where need be to create like balance in the force of good and evil, you know? And I don't know. I don't know how much he knew. And this is where the series gets really interesting, right? Because this is the first time where as readers, we can be like, well, why didn't Dumbledore do more to protect Sirius? And as we read, it's like, well, maybe he wasn't motivated to do more to protect Sirius because Sirius was just perfectly fine where he was. You know, why didn't Dumbledore do more to protect James and Lily? Well, maybe because this is the way it had to happen.
And to be fair, this was
the destiny of the story.
Absolutely. And to be fair, Dumbledore did try and protect James and Lily. He did. He had suggested like, I could be your secret keeper, but he didn't like tell them, I need to be your secret keeper. Right. This is what's going to keep you safe. And like it's just like, was that also a part of his plan? It's just kind of a dark question to ponder.
Think we're even going to see it in, I watched Goblet of Fire last night. So we're even going to see it in Goblet of Fire where, you know, they're after Harry's name gets chosen out of the goblet and they're, you know, it's the other two school headmasters and Snape and McGonagall and Fudge, and they're all in Dumbledore's office talking about, is Harry going to compete or not compete? And Fudge kind of says like, well, he
is
has,
Crouch?
Oh, it's Barty Crouch. Thank you. Sorry. I have Fudge on the mind. You know, Barty Crouch kind of is like, well, these are the rules. He has to compete. And of course this is the movie, not the book. So, but Snape says to Dumbledore, you know, headmaster, perhaps we should just allow these events to play out and see, you know, what is supposed to be happening here. And Dumbledore is like, yeah, I agree. I think this is just something we have to let it play out. And he takes his memory and he puts it into the Pensieve. And I just think that, I don't know, Dumbledore has this like mystic wiseness to him, but he's also manipulative and also cunning. And I do think he does the things he does for the greater good. But the greater good is not that like Harry prevails or that everybody lives and it's magical and happy. The greater good is that like a lot of people are gonna die, but Dumbledore will die, you know? And I'll die and Dumbledore will die. And then the world can be rid of this and we don't have to deal with it anymore.
Yeah. And it's like, it's weird going back to what you said about like viewing Dumbledore as like a godlike figure. It's sort of, I don't know the author's religious affiliations. I don't know that she has any, but it's sort of an indication about how maybe she thinks about God, because like comparing this to Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan is like the God figure in that series is benevolent and loving, mm-hmm. and like, but this is also because C.S. Lewis was like a very strong Christian, but like as like the way that Aslan acts as the sort of godhead in that series is completely different to how Dumbledore acts as sort of the god figure in this series. It is not how how sort of we would see a loving God acting.
Yeah, it's very, I don't know, it's very interesting. And I think Dumbledore's, his attitude towards Voldemort is so powerful, you know. One of my favorite moments is when they encounter each other in the Ministry in Order of the Phoenix, and Dumbledore is like, it was unwise for you to come here tonight, Tom.
And it's a power just, move like, to call him by his first
yeah,
name.
Yeah, just the way he just, like, he treats Voldemort like the small, insecure child who he taught at Hogwarts. Yeah. And he, like, never stops treating him like that. He doesn't give him power to his name. He doesn't give him importance. He doesn't do any of that. And he faces Voldemort like an equal. And I think it's really important for Harry to see that, because we see Harry sort of transition from
that way.
He who must not be named to, well, you're just Tom Riddle. And like, you know, you didn't kill me once and you're not going to kill me again. Like, let's do this.
Yeah. Let's get that straight. Well, yeah, he does, but it's fine. No, you're right. That's a good point.
One of my, so I guess going back to the book, sorry, that was a very
back to the end of the, no, that was, I think that was a good discussion.
I love that Percy says he has some overhauls he wants to make in the Department of Magical Law Enforcement.
I know. He's like, I'm going to come in and catch Sirius Black. I'm like, okay, Percy, calm down.
And then of course,
Tony
ironic.
The only person who would listen, his girlfriend.
Right. And ironic that he is going to be a big part of denying Voldemort's return.
Yeah. Like, he does not help at all. Not at first, at least. Gryffindor wins the House Cup largely because of the Quidditch championship.
Mm-hmm.
It says that they're the noisiest table at the feast, which I've never felt so seen as a Gryffindor. I would be over there screaming and being obnoxious. We find out how Sirius obtained the Firebolt. He sent Crookshanks with a mail order, but and put Harry's name on it, but told them to access his Gringotts vault, which, like, somebody should have thought that was fishy, but at the same time, they're like, oh, Sirius is Harry's legal... I don't know! It's very
it's so
weird.
Fishy. It's completely really fishy. They would have been better just not explaining it, to be honest.
Then again, it's like, this is another thing of, like, the goblins and Gringotts are, like, are not, like, on the good side or the bad side. They're just sort of neutral.
Yeah, they're money motivated from what we know.
Yeah. And then Sirius sends Harry a letter on the train. He signs his Hogsmeade permission slip.
Cute, but like,
and
what?
I mean, Harry's just going to give it to Dumbledore, and Dumbledore's like, I get it. And then he gets Ron this new little owl.
Yeah, he does a cute little owl. I thought it was very sweet. And sort of, Harry, I think we kind of talked about it, but Harry's school years typically end with him thinking that it will be better than the last, and this is kind of like a sort of a turn.
Yeah, and it's like, even Harry says, he's like, nothing made a difference, and it did. Like, he saved, you know, he saved Sirius from his fate and saved Buckbeak, but Peter Pettigrew is still out there on the loose. There's mm-hmm. a lot of loose ends to be tied up still.
And what did the prophecy say? That the servant will rejoin his master. Yeah.
Yep.
So kind of the last, I think, really cute thing here is Harry meets his uncle at King's Cross, and
it's
he
so
tells
good.
Uncle Vernon
Can I
that
right
yeah
so Harry meets with Uncle Vernon, and Vernon goes what's that? If it's another form for me to sign, you've got another, probably about to say you've got another thing coming. And Harry goes, it's not, it's a letter from my godfather. You haven't got a godfather. Harry goes, yes, I have. He was my mom and dad's best friend. He's a convicted murderer, but he's broken out of wizarding prison and he's on the run. He likes to keep in touch with me, though. Keep up with my news. Check if I'm happy. Just like threatening Vernon flat out.
Little James.
Totally. Totally. So he gets to stick it to Vernon a little bit. And that's the end of the book.
That's the end of the book. Yeah. Any final thoughts?
Oh, I was the happiest reading this one. Out of all of them, it's just my favorite. It's so good. Introduction of my favorite characters. Just what is there to be said more than I've already said? There's so much extra lore around this one too that there is to, you know, find out from other things. Yeah, it's just this one. I think the reason I love Prisoner of Azkaban the most is it sparked my interest as far as the plot of the series goes the most. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is going to lead to a lot more stuff.
Yeah, this sort of, I think, like, lit the match for the series that was like, okay, this was good, this was good. Okay, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
And we the author builds a much more compelling story in this book. We start to get more adult characters who are going to become really important. We sort of get more backstory. We start learning, like, oh, there's prophecies. Okay, we know Trelawney has made two prophecies. We just heard about one. What's the other, you know? We get a little bit more something.
Yeah, there's more substance.
And it's going to be really, just really interesting. And there's a lot of, like, foreshadowing in this book. A lot of calls to future things, you know? I kind of think when Lupin has his final for the students to, you know, do, and it's a series of tasks, I think that's sort of a shout out to the Triwizard Tournament and Harry having to go through different little tasks, and sort of Lupin sort of set Harry up for success with that. I think there's just a lot of, you know, little reaches that start to show that the author is really thinking and building a world and like a sort of a complete plot here.
Yeah.
And I like
that. For sure.
This takes it from children's book to adult book.
Absolutely. My final thought is, as soon as I finished the last word of this book, I just like hugged it. It's just one of those books that's like, I just hugged it. I like held it to my chest. Yeah. I love this book.
Is Order of the Phoenix your second favorite after this one? Yeah, correct. That makes sense.
Good guess.
Yeah.
Anything with the most Lupin and serious content you can get.
I'm really excited for Goblet of Fire because I'm excited to like reread the Yule Ball and the Triwizard Tournament because I know it happens, you know, quite differently in the book, and so it's been a while since I reread that one, so I'm excited.
I'm excited to talk about all the other wizarding schools and the Quidditch World Cup.
So that's it on our book series on Prisoner of Azkaban. The next time you'll hear about Prisoner of Azkaban, we're going to be watching the movie. And we talk a little bit in our movie episodes about the differences between book and movie, but really the sort of meat of that is the recasting of the characters that we do. We sort of talk about that and just kind of chat a little bit more about our love for the book. It's less plot and just more us rambling, but it's fun.
Our movie episodes are so fun. I love our movie episodes.
Yeah, we love them. And then we will, I think, maybe do a Q&A.
An Owl Post episode.
Our Owl Post episode. So send in your questions for our Owl Post episode.
We'll put another little box in Instagram stories.
Mm-hmm. And then we're going to kick off Goblet of Fire. And I think we'll be in Goblet of Fire for like 3 months because it's a very long book.
It's so long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we can find a way to sort of make it go faster. But I think I love our like really detailed conversation. So I don't know that I want to do that.
No, I don't want to. You'll just have to deal with
Goblet of Fire for a long time.
You're here because you like to listen to us ramble, I think.
And we're grateful that you do.
Yeah, we are grateful that you do. So anyway, so that's it. That's Prisoner of Azkaban. We'll see you next time with your popcorn and at the movies.
Signing off. The Daily Profcast.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email.